19th of November, the Ukraine war passed 1,000 days, and the Ukrainian position is looking as precarious as ever. Since the US presidential election, there has been significant speculation about what Donald Trump's victory means for the war in Ukraine. Trump's campaign pledged to end the war quickly, combined with his veiled threats of suspending US financial and military aid for Ukraine to force Kiev to negotiate with Moscow, have raised questions about whether the conflict could end in 2025. In just over 2 months, the Ukraine war will be 3 years old, and it seems now the beginning of the end is upon us. Here to break this all down is Geopolity founder Adnan Karb. Adnan, we've been watching the Ukraine war on Geopolity very closely ever since it began. We last sat down near the end of 2023 to look at where things were. Where would you say things stand currently?
So yeah, Yusuf, it's nearly been a year actually, just over a year since we last sat down, and really things have actually got worse for Ukraine since we last sat down and discussed this. So when we sat down at the end of 2023, Ukraine struggled in its counteroffensive. The counteroffensive it did effectively failed. And really since then, what's been going on is Ukraine has actually been losing land. Russia has slowly been eating up small tracts of land. And this year, 2024, really is a story of, can Ukraine form more resources at this war? And it's turned into a battle of attrition that who can last, who can put more resources in. And it's a bit like World War One, where a lot of resources would have to be dedicated just to take over small tracts of land. So really, as we're coming up to the third year anniversary, the Ukrainian position is probably the worst it's ever been. And in Russia, despite how poorly it started the war, its position is improved and it's really on top in this war.
There's lots of discussions of ending the war. Trump said he will do so in 24 hours. I mean, that is Trump. I remember, Adnan, there was a lot of talk about however long it takes. As far as I can see, Ukraine is losing and it's not winning. So why is there so much talk of ending the war?
So what's happened, Yusuf, is the US input, the US support for this war, despite the rhetoric, was always going to be limited. There's obviously been a lot of rhetoric, as long as it takes, you know, we will be there. We can't let this dictator, modern day Hitler, do what he wants. You've got to stand up to bullies. But the reality is the US doesn't share a border with Ukraine. The US importance it will give to this conflict was always going to be limited despite its rhetoric. So what's happened now is as we're coming up to 3 years, the US has actually been quite open that, look, we've given you what we can. As Ukrainians, you need to do the best you can with the resources we've given you. And really, over to you. It's down to you now to make the best use of what we've given you. Don't expect us to fight your war. Don't expect us to keep giving you a blank check. And now they're actually being quite open with this. So really, the current position in the US is we've given you loads of money. They've even given the reserves Russia has in Western banks, which they've seized. They've even given about $30 billion from that to the Ukrainians. And effectively what they've said is, look, this is our last contribution now. You now need to use everything we've given you to try and win this. And without saying it, what they're saying is, if you can't, then that is the position we're going to start the next stage, which I'm sure we're going to discuss, which is about ending the war. And that means something very different in Washington than it does in Kiev. So really, for the last year where Ukraine hasn't made much progress, it's become more and more difficult for the Biden administration to pass legislation or get approval for more funding. In Europe, they've always been very, very reluctant to increase the amount of aid they're giving. They give aid, but it's never enough to make a difference on the battlefield. So with Trump coming in, he is just saying what has been the ground reality. So when he says, I want to end this, when he says, I want to end this in 24 hours, well, this is the direction we were going anyway. We weren't going in the direction where America's increasing its contribution, where America's saying we're going to give you more sophisticated weapons. Really, the discussions and what's coming out of Washington for the last year is all about, we've done what we can, over to you. And really, you've done the most you can now. So we need to think about talk. And obviously, the problem with talks is Ukraine is not in a position of strength for this talk. It's lost 20% of its territory. So the reason why there's lots of discussion is if this war continues, it means more American money. And Trump ran a campaign of ending the forever wars. In fact, there is a lot of opposition in America to continue contributing towards this war effort. And again, I go back to what I said at the beginning of this question, Yusuf. America's support was always going to be limited. You know, Ukraine are now the new Kurds. they've now experienced what America did to the Syrian rebel groups, which is, we'll help you, but we're not going to help you to win the war. We're not going to help you to overthrow the regime. That's really down to you. So America wanted credit to being involved, but America was never going to give, it was never going to put troops on the ground. It was never going to give you sophisticated weapons. And really, Zelensky should have known this from the beginning. You know, Ukraine's been invaded by its neighbor nation, not America. So America will support you to some degree, but America doesn't view this conflict the way Ukraine does. And really, that's why Zelensky should have considered other options, really. But he brought in two Western promises. And, you know, like we said, however long it takes now has been replaced to you need to begin talks with Russia.
So Adan, we see the difference with US foreign policy towards Israel. They're going to defend them regardless. And we're seeing this now with Ukraine. It's very limited. Why is Ukraine not seen as important to American standards? Why the difference between the two?
So Zelensky would have hoped that Ukraine is the Israel of Europe and the West would come to their aid the way they always come to the aid of Israel. In fact, with Israel, irrespective of which party you are, left or right or center, they always support Israel. They believe they have to maintain its security. Zelensky wished Ukraine was like that, but in truth, you're not Israel. And actually, you were never going to be seen as Israel because there's some major differences. Firstly, American policy towards the Middle East is different to American policy in Europe. Secondly, Israel as a nation was created to be a forward base for the West. So it's created by the British and the French at the time, and it was taken over by America. So one of America's strategic positions in the Middle East is the security of Israel. So America will provide it with security, provide it with a lifestyle, and Israel's job is to protect American interests in the region. So America, whether you're Democrat, Republican, or whoever in America, your view has always been that we have to maintain Israeli security, we have to maintain the military edge, and that's how they can achieve their interests. So this has been the case really since the creation of Israel. In Europe, America has relationship with multiple countries. America has a strategy to balance different countries out. You've got Britain, you've got France, you've got Germany, you've got all the other nations that have joined NATO. So Ukraine is just one nation amongst many. And in fact, up until 1990, Ukraine was behind the Iron Curtain. So after 1991, America has been involved in Ukraine during the color revolution and things like this. So you can see the evolution of both countries is very different. American interests are very different. You never hear in America, we've given too much aid to Israel. We need to stop giving aid. You've had some occasions over the last year because of Gaza, the Biden administration has restricted the transfer of certain weapons or the amount of weapons. This is very different to what happens with Israel generally. Usually the aid every year gets authorized. They give even other aid beyond what in their defense budget. So whilst, yes, Zelensky would hope he's the Israel of Europe, the reality is he's not, because America has many, many options in Europe to protect its interests. Ukraine is just really a proxy, unfortunately. It's brutal what's happening to the Ukrainians. It's been happening for 3 years. I get that. But in truth, America looks at this conflict, not we care about Ukraine. They see it as we have competition with a power called Russia. And Ukraine now is a proxy that we can use to achieve our other goals. So Ukraine for America is a means to an end. And that's why their support is not endless, because they know proxies are only useful to a certain degree. They achieve things for you. They can get worn out. They're not very capable. So America is very practical. And America has other options. It has NATO. It has many Eastern European countries. It has bilateral relations with. It has a very deep military relationship with Germany. You've got the UK. In the Middle East, it's a different setup. And that's why Israel is more central to their plan. And that's why, by the problems of occupation being the same, America views them very differently.
So what can we expect when Trump comes into office? It's not long now, just under 2 months.
So Donald Trump, Yusuf, he's made it very clear he wants to end this war. He's made the claim he will end it in 24 hours. And let's take him for his word. He wants to end the war, maybe not 24 hours. Now, what does that mean? Because Trump ending the war, it means something very different to what me and you understand as ending the war. And it means something very different to what the Ukrainians understand of ending the war. So when Trump is talking about ending the war, he's saying, whatever the current status is, I'm going to sit the two parties together and we're going to bring the war to an end. What that means is the 20% of Ukrainian territory Ukraine has lost, you have lost, and effectively you're not going to get it back. That's effectively what Trump is saying. He is going to end the war on the terms that we have currently. He's not talking about we're going to up military support, reverse what Russia's done, and Ukraine's territorial integrity remains. He's not talking about that. He's actually saying whatever the current status is, we're going to go on that. And I don't think the Ukrainians have completely cocked on that's what he means. I think they're assuming there'd be a surge and then there'd be talks. What he's saying is, no, I'm going to come, I'm going to sit you both down. So if you think about Yusuf from that perspective, how on earth can Ukraine enter talks with no bargaining power? Why does Russia need to enter talks when you're winning? If America's saying, well, we're going to rubber stamp the current status quo, that serves Russia. So we've seen in the past, Yusuf, Trump is very transactional. He doesn't care. And I mentioned to you before, it's a means to an end for America. Ukraine is not a strategic interest for them. It's a means to an end. America has loads of sanctions on Russia. Those sanctions now will be used one by one to get agreements from Russia. So America's got what it can out of this war. Ukraine obviously hasn't. It's lost its territory. And that's why I say for America, Ukraine was just a proxy, unfortunately. So if Trump does deliver, it will be on the current status. So in America, he will sell it as, I've ended the war. He will sell it globally as, look, I'm the guy that can bring wars to an end. And in Moscow, they'll be laughing all the way to the Kremlin because they've got what they want in the end. And this is what Trump is.
I remember at the beginning of the war, they were talking about sanctions and how these sanctions would actually cripple Russia. This hasn't really been the case. Why is that?
So very simply, Yusuf, Russia isn't Syria, it's not Iran, it's not Venezuela, it's not Cuba. It is a $1 trillion plus economy. It has significant energy and other mineral assets. And as a result, Russia had lots of ways to navigate around these sanctions. So what Russia did is really since 2014, when it invaded Crimea and took it over, Russia's been preparing for the scenario where its economy will be attacked by the West. So really, it already started moving towards decoupling its supply chains that rely on the West. It was already trying to move away and become more self-sufficient. So they call this strategy Fortress Russia. So it was already in place really for a number of years before the sanctions began. Now, the sanctions were quite extensive. There's 16,000 sanctions on Russia. That includes they've been booted out of the international financial system. They are no longer on SWIFT, and bans have been put in place on importing and exporting different forms of energy to and from Russia. The number one strategy Russia had is it's replaced the decline in energy sales to Europe with China. So if I remember, Yusuf, around 180 billion cubic meters of gas used to go from Russia to Europe. Now it's down to about 15 billion. That's a significant drop. What Russia's done is they've replaced the European market completely with mainly China, and then you've got India as well. So there's not been a decline in revenues for Russia when it came to energy export. They've just replaced who they send them to. Because Russia is a $1 trillion economy and it has its own mineral assets, it was never going to be straightforward, really, to completely cripple them. They're not a Cuba. They're not a Venezuela. The other thing Russia's been doing is been buying up lots of gold. It's actually been literally physically delivering gold as payment to a number of countries. With China, Russia and China now have their own payment system that goes around all the global systems. The other thing Russia's done, Yusuf, is it's set up a shadow fleet of tankers that carry its gas and oil to different parts of the world. So when you look at any vessel, Yusuf, on the oceans, how do you tell which country it belongs to? Because I can outsource the transfer of oil to a freight agent, to a foreign company. So there's no way when you're looking at a tanker to see who it belongs to. So Russia can sell oil to Iran. And when the tanker turns up, it's a British tank. It has British workers on there. It has a French chef on there. There's no way to physically work it out. And these tankers can transfer energy between themselves in the middle of the ocean as well. So all of this strategy means that the sanctions have not had the desired effect. They've had an impact. Russia's had to throw lots more money at its economy. But it's not crippled Russia. But crippling Russia, I think, was more rhetorical. You were never going to cripple Russia. Russia isn't a Cuba or a Venezuela. It is, I think, the 10th or 12th largest economy in the world. And because China has stepped in, Russia has prevailed on this front.
The war is on the European continent, but I don't really see much coming from Europe. It's mainly the US. What's Europe actually doing, and how is it faring with the economic war?
You're right, Yusuf. The war is on the European continent, but for some reason, America is leading the response to this war. So you find funding overwhelmingly has come from the US. When it's come to weapons transfers, it's come from the US mainly, but America's been really pushing Europe. It's been pushing Germany, it's been pushing Britain, it's been pushing France and the other EU countries to really up their contribution. What it seems to be, Yusuf, is Europe wants to defend the continent against Russia, but they effectively want America to do the lion's share of the work. And this is why Trump's claim the Europeans need to up their game, NATO needs to up their game, the Europeans need to contribute more, has been a growing call in America. And if we just take the specific example of Germany, every time it's come to transferring a weapon to Ukraine, a big debate starts in Germany. Germany says yes, no, we will, maybe, with conditions. In the end, they provide the weapon to Ukraine, but it's in such small quantities, it would make no difference. And it seems Germany wants to maintain this posture that we're not warmongers. We are a diplomatic and political power and economic power, and we don't want war. But you've cut your ties with Russia. You no longer import energy from Russia to send them a sign that you're unhappy with what they've done. So you'd think they would put their resources, full resources, into this war. But this is Europe for you. What Europe wants is America does the heavy lifting. America takes care of our security. So the Europeans don't need to put money into their defense. And this has been the rallying cry from Trump, that the Europeans need to pull their socks up. The Europeans need to take the lead on this. And the problem now is you've just got a generation of politicians who believe that security is the job of America. Everything else, politics, economics, they're prepared to take the front position. When it comes to security, their expectation is America will do it. Now, there are repercussions for this. It means you're dependent upon America. It means America can interfere more on the continent. But it seems that the Europeans are just so used to America dealing with security, they just expect them to take the lead. And this has caused a lot of tension with America, because on very, very simple things, like if you think about, Yusuf, when Ukraine wanted tanks, it doesn't make sense for America to put these tanks on aircraft carriers and ship these over to Europe, when Germany, Poland, across Europe, all these countries have American tanks. But what happened was, if these countries give a portion of their tanks to Ukraine, they're then going to be under-resourced. So they're going to have to buy more tanks, and they don't want to do that. So they've been dragging their feet over this. So this is the European position. It's quite shocking. So all this talk of conscription, a draft, World War III, it takes place in the context where they just expect America to do the heavy lifting.
So, okay, Europe's not giving really much support. It's all up to the US. If the US could give Ukraine the actual support it needed to defeat Russia, why doesn't it actually do that?
It doesn't do this, Yusuf, because the US and Ukraine are not the same page. They're not on the same page on this. So if the American leader and the Ukrainian leader are sitting in Kiev and they look to the east of Ukraine and you can see Russia invading, they are not looking at the same thing. They're looking at two very different things. Ukraine is looking at existential threat. Our country's going to get run over. America's not looking like that. America is looking at it very differently. What America is looking at is we were in a decades-long war, the Cold War, with Russia. And Russia expanded all the way to Berlin in Germany. And in 1991, Russia collapsed. And since then, America, with the help of Europe, they pushed Russia all the way back to its current borders. And one by one, through NATO and through the EU, they've been swallowing up all the former Soviet republics. So for them, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is just a continuation of the Cold War. It is a continuation of this long battle where the border between the West and Russia constantly changes. So whilst Ukraine is seeing it as we are being invaded, we need to defend our country, America's seeing it as this is just part of decade-long battle that we've been having with Russia. So America's view is this is going to continue. If it wasn't Ukraine, it will be another country. So America doesn't see the need to throw all its resources at this when this is just part of an ongoing battle that these two entities will continue having. So effectively, what America's done is what it did in Syria, which is we'll arm you, but we're never going to give you the weapons to make a difference, because they didn't see it as that as their interest. And keep in mind, Yusuf, if Russia wasn't invading Europe, Europe would not be collaborating with America. Europe would not need security from America. In fact, on many issues, Europe will stand up to America. By Russia being a problem, the Europeans have to run to America. So that means America strategically needs Russia to be a problem, but it needs to make sure Russia doesn't overrun Europe, because if Russia overruns Europe, Russia will become a continental power. Then you become a threat to America. America's global strategy, Yusuf, is that the biggest problem in the world for them is Eurasia. Why Eurasia? Because Eurasia is the place where there are other powers or where other powers can rise. So this is where you have Russia, it's where you have China, it's where you have France, it's where you have Britain, it's where you have Germany, it's where you have all countries that have been powers in the past. So if anyone comes to dominate this continent, they will then rival America. This is the American view. So from that context, Ukraine is just one little dot. And so I do get it. I mean, I don't want to play this down. You know, if you're Ukrainian, it's existential for you. America, this is existential. For America, why would we put all our eggs in the Ukraine basket when we are competing against Russia in different parts of the world? Ukraine is just one of them. And as brutally cold as that sounds, that is America's calculation. That's why, despite America having the capabilities, despite it having tanks, despite having intelligence, despite having a massive air force, despite it having sufficient resources to arm Ukraine who can defeat Russia, America doesn't view it like that. America views it as this is just one little dot amongst many dots. And really, there are other more important places we're going to be dealing with Russia. And that's their cold geopolitical calculations.
Okay, so recently we had soldiers from North Korea come to support Russia. North Korea has entered the war. Why has Russia turned to them? Are they in desperate need of them? Is Russia actually losing a lot of soldiers and therefore turning to North Korea?
So I was really surprised how much media attention this is getting, because I don't think any country needs to be really scared if North Korean soldiers are coming to their country. They're not known to be pretty good at war. But the context of this is quite interesting. Russia now has been at war. We're coming up to 3 years. It's technically been at war in Ukraine since 2014. When it invaded 3 years ago, it mobilized its army and its society. So as the war goes on, it's going to start impacting your economy. As you're throwing more soldiers at this, soldiers are going to die, they're going to become crippled, you've got to bring more soldiers in. And as this goes on, it will start to drain. So one way you can resource a war when it goes on is you get external help. So you buy weapons, you buy missiles, and you're getting soldiers. So Russia has been getting drones from Iran. So that means now Russia doesn't have to worry about producing and its factories and them getting energy to produce these drones. So there's drones coming from Iran. They were missiles and bullets and artillery coming from North Korea. And now we've got these troops as well. Specifically, Yusuf, these North Korean troops are being used in the Kursk region. So this is the area that borders Russia. This is the area that borders Ukraine, where there was no war going on. And what Ukraine did in August, it invaded mainland Russia. And interestingly, it invaded an area, Kursk, which is not really populated much. And actually, it's very unlikely Ukraine would be able to maintain this occupation. In fact, they've already lost half of Kursk already. So really, this Kursk invasion was a last throw of the dice from Ukraine. It was Ukraine's attempt to try and mix up what it's doing. Because really, for the last year, Yusuf, from the Donbass region all the way down to Crimea, this is an 800-mile front. This is where the war is. And this is consuming all of Ukraine's resources. So what Ukraine did is, let's open up a front somewhere completely different. This will force Russia to move troops from the main front to over here. What Putin has done is, rather than fall for this and mean there's a front which is going to be weak, it's actually drawn upon foreign troops to come and fight there. So from a strategic war perspective, that's a very sensible strategy. So it meant Russia didn't ease up on any of the 800-mile front. What Russia's done is, to deal with this, it's got foreign troops. And what that means is Ukraine has basically used some very good troops that should have been fighting on the front. It's moved them to Kursk. And now those areas where these troops were in Ukraine, those areas are now being lost. So really what Putin's done, and he's been doing this throughout the war, every time Putin comes across a problem, every time his troops fail, rather than bog down, rather than dig his heels and try and get a victory no matter what, and you lose lots of troops and weapons, what he does is he withdraws his troops and he saves them to fight another day. So what Russia has done by turning to North Korea is it saved his troops for another day, rather than they get bogged down. And also, Kursk, this isn't the main battlefront. Although it looks bad diplomatically, you know, mainland Russia has been taken over, Putin didn't fall for them. So that's really the broader context here.
One country we've not heard much from is China. What's China's position, and does it actually still stand by Russia?
So China is in a bit of a bind. China's integrated into the global economy. America is its number one market. It wants this to continue. On the other hand, it has this semi-alliance with Russia as well. So what you see with China is it supports Russia sometimes. There's sometimes it criticizes Russia when Russia does things that has a broader impact on the economy or the global system. So what China is doing, it's taking Russian energy. It's taking whatever economic resources Russia is prepared to give China. So in that sense, it is economically helping Russia. However, China sees Ukraine as a battle between Europe and Russia. It doesn't view Ukraine like Taiwan. It doesn't see the war as something it needs to give resources to because Russia can deal with that. So what China is effectively doing is we support Russia because Russia is an ally of ours. However, we still want to maintain good relations with the West. So you've seen a few times the West has criticized China when it's apparently going to give heavy weapons to Russia. And it's criticized it because it's saying that, look, you shouldn't be getting involved. It just says, yeah, we're not getting involved. We're buying energy, but anybody can buy energy from Russia. That's not a military support. So effectively, China wants to get both sides. It still wants to continue trade and its economic relationship with the West. On the other hand, it still wants to support Russia as well. So what it's really doing is its support for Russia is very low. There hasn't been, as far as we know, massive weapons transfers, things like that. But that's not what Russia needs. Russia doesn't really need weapons from China. What Russia really needs is we're not selling energy to Europe anymore. So we need a new market. And that's what China is. And China's more than happy to buy Russian energy. So China, what it's really learned is if this is what America can do to Russia in terms of sanctions, China's even more integrated into the global economy. So this sanction will have even bigger effect. So China is learning the lessons from this, is working out how it navigates this. But really, although everybody says China is on Russia's side, physically on the ground, that doesn't really mean much because this is a Russia war and Russia needs to deal with it. Same if China invaded Taiwan, you wouldn't see a massive involvement from Russia because that's China's problem. We would diplomatically support it, but China has to deal with it and China has the resources to deal with it as well. So China really is trying to get a bit from both worlds.
US President Biden, he's recently permitted Ukraine to use long strikes into Russia. Will this actually have any impact?
So no, it won't, Yusuf, because it's too late in the day. Secondly, a few strikes here and there doesn't alter the battlefield reality. The battlefield reality, there's an 800-mile front. 20% of Ukraine is occupied by Russia. The only way to reverse this is a massive influx of troops and weaponry to a Ukrainian front, and then they push the Russian front back. What the assumption has been with long-range strikes is if Ukraine strikes deep into Russia, this would cause tension in Russia. It would cause people to turn against the war. But because these long-range strikes are so far and few between, they're just not going to have any impact. And America doesn't want to increase long-range strikes. It doesn't want to increase the tempo of the war. This may lead to Russia increasing what it's doing. Russia, for the moment, is more than happy to keep a war attrition going on the front in eastern Ukraine. It doesn't need to change that. That is taking up so much resources of Ukraine. It just needs to continue this, and Ukraine is going to be crippled, which it more or less is. So really, this doesn't change. So this seems to be more political from Biden. Biden's got, another 2 months? What effectively he's doing is give Ukraine whatever they need for when Trump comes in. And when Trump comes in, talks are going to start. And the best position Ukraine can be in is if it increases attacks into Russia, the hope is they've got something to go in these talks with. But really, this is, in one way, it's a last throw of the dice, really.
There's a lot of talk about nuclear weapons. Once again, I think we have this conversation every single time we talk about Ukraine. What's the chances of nuclear weapons being used in war?
So I think, Yusuf, Putin has now lost the right to use this card. You only get one or two chances to cry wolf, then you've got to deliver. He hasn't. It's like the fifth or sixth time now he's talking about nukes. You haven't used them previously, so why should we believe you now? What Putin usually does is he cries nukes when there's potentially a major escalation. So the recent nuclear remarks have come on the back of Ukraine doing long-range strikes and getting approved for long-range strikes into Russia. So what Russia's saying is, if the West is going to up its support for Ukraine, then we potentially would consider using nukes. Now, for all practical purposes, Yusuf, the eastern border of Ukraine is under 300 miles from Moscow. So Moscow is just a few hundred miles away from Ukraine. If Russia was to use a nuke, you're going to get a massive radioactive crater in Ukraine, in the heart of Europe. Nuclear fallout doesn't respect borders. If you remember the Chernobyl incident, it didn't respect borders. So really, because you share a border with this country, you can't really use a nuke because the radioactive fallout is going to affect you as well. It's going to come into Russia as well. So this is more, when you talk about nukes, people remember Chernobyl, they remember the Cold War. It gets people on their toes. So that's the impact Putin's trying to do, that if you do this, then Russia will consider the nuclear option. And obviously nobody wants a nuclear fallout. Nobody wants a nuclear strikes. But it's all talk. From a political perspective, it achieves creating this fear for Putin. From a strategic, practical perspective, it is the most impractical weapon to use in this war. And if Russia's winning, why would you use nukes? Why do you need to use nukes when you're on the winning side? So really, it's all just political. It's all really just part of the information war.
Final question for you, Adnan. Is World War III closer or further away?
So a continental-wide war is not really in anyone's interest. It's not in Russia's interest. It's definitely not in the European interest. If there was a European-wide war, it would devastate the continent, it would devastate the global economy. So from that perspective, it's in no one's interest. But the calculation from the West is Russia has taken over 20% of Ukraine, so Russia has expanded. And in throughout history, Yusuf, when a European power expands on the continent, it has required the other powers on the continent to come together and stop it. So when Napoleon did this, the Europeans went to war with him. When Kaiser Wilhelm did this in World War I, the Europeans went to war with him. When Hitler did it in World War II, they went to war with him. So whatever the outcome in this specific war is, there is the broader context here that Russia has expanded. And if Russia has expanded and it consolidated that expansion, then what's to stop Russia taking other territories? So in the long run, Yusuf, it seems the Europeans have accepted that there will be a continental-wide war at some point. And that's why there's all these talks of a draft, there's all these talks of conscription, there's all these talks of expanding the defense budget, there's all this talk of the defense industry and manufacturing now needs investment, because in the long run, how do you turn Russia back? So from that second perspective, Yusuf, World War III is probably more closer. But both world wars that happened in the past, Yusuf, before they started, it was in no one's interest. It wouldn't suit anybody. But because of this competition between the West, because that border between the Western Europe has constantly moved, there's constantly been wars on the continent. So I wouldn't say you can completely write off the prospects of World War III. Nobody believed in 1910, in 1912, that there'd be a continent-wide war in 1914. Throughout the 1930s, nobody thought there would be a war. In 1939, 1940, they were at war. So these things have a habit of very quickly changing. What we do know through history, despite periods of cooperation between the West and Europe, despite periods of peace, the underlying trend has always been one of competition, and both entities try to use all the tools, military, diplomatic, economic, social, to push their borders further into each other's territory. So war is politics through other means. The politics will continue, which is the battle between these two entities. Whether it turns to war, we don't know, but I would say probably a continental-wide war is probably more closer now than it was maybe a year ago. However, it isn't in anyone's interest, but war is usually not in anyone's interest, but they still happen. So I think that's probably the context to really view it in.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com, all one word. You can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.